Welcome to this edition of Game Changers Live. This is your host, Dennis Troianos. Today, I'm delighted to be here with Gavin McElroy. Gavin is a partner at Frankfurt Kernit Klein & Sells, a leading media, entertainment, and advertising law firm based in New York. Gavin is a partner at the firm and chair of the firm's M&A practice and chair of the firm's executive compensation and employment practice group. During his tenure at the firm, Gavin has worked on well over 100 M&A deals in the marketing services, advertising, PR, and digital agency world. In addition, Gavin works on approximately 100 executive employment deals per year. Gavin has been at the firm since 1987. Gavin, welcome to Game Changers Live.
Thanks, Dennis. Glad to be here.
Gavin, you're one of the preeminent executive compensation attorneys in the country, if not the world. And what I'd like to do is start the conversation by asking you what level of executive would most benefit from the services of someone like you?
Dennis, my practice covers a wide spectrum. While I have represented a handful of CEOs of companies and a couple of CEOs of public companies, I often go down to the level of someone getting their first serious job offer or receiving an agreement which contains restrictive covenants that have some concern to them. It's a practice that covers a variety of areas and issues, and it's as much as helping people understand the offer they're being made on an economic level, on a business level, as well as the actual documentation for the deal.
What are they trying to typically achieve when they go through the process with you? What do they want to roll out at the end of the tube, if you will?
Well, they're hoping to roll out a new position, or they wouldn't be coming from me,
right,
to me, which happens in the vast majority of the situations. But I always want them to understand what's going on. Particularly, many of my clients are creative executives, mm-hmm, and less experienced in thinking about things from financial long-term goals and looking at not only what the new offer is, but what their current offer is and their current position is, and perhaps using their current position to better negotiate the new offer.
So you're really functioning as both a legal counsel as well as a helping them put the offer of employment into a broader perspective.
Well, obviously I'm a lawyer and that's what I do for a living, but I help people think about their job offer and what it means and where they're going, and particularly what it means as compared to what they have, because it is not that unusual for certain executives, especially those who are less business savvy, to not really understand even what their current issue, what their current deal is, mm-hmm, and what long-term benefits may already exist.
I see. So that leads me to this question. How do you aggressively protect an executive's legal interests without blowing up the deal in certain cases, right? Which could happen. There's a risk tolerance there.
There's always a risk tolerance. If someone offers you a contract and you make any suggestion, however, you have to think about it in a lot of different ways. One of which is, does a company really want to hire an executive to a mid-level to senior position who wouldn't even think about asking for other things and negotiating the deal perhaps to the better? One of the things I try to do when an executive comes in is start with the question, why do you want the job? At times the executives look at me kind of awestruck and say, why would you ask such a question? But the reason is it helps you think about what the most important issues are. Does someone want the job because they don't have a job? Does someone want the job because they want to break into a new industry? Does someone want the job because they want to break into a new sector of the industry? They're in advertising, but they want to get involved in digital advertising. Are they taking a job because it's more of a long-term equity play? Are they taking the job because of their age? They think this is their last landing spot and they're looking for more security. So one of the things that I think is important is to understand why the job is attractive and what is attractive about it. So to think about where one may push or where one may push harder.
Mm-hmm. Now, you brought up the issue of equity play, and in our practice, we see, you know, of course, senior people are more and more asking us about equity involvement. Are you seeing more equity offers today as opposed to 3 to 5 years ago, or the reverse?
To some degree, I think I might actually be seeing less. I have done literally hundreds of deals involving executives in equity and have a certain amount of expertise dealing with the tax consequences and the business consequences and how to think about it. But as the economy has started to improve, I think more companies actually have cash, have profits, and are paying people closer to market salary. Probably 4 or 5 years ago, where there were mass layoffs in the media world, many of those executives started their own companies and then would hire friends and colleagues from similar backgrounds who had lost their positions. And these were people who would often be taking jobs at half or less of what compensation they would be making elsewhere, in which case you really need to think about how you are an investor in the company. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a deal where you're making a more or less market salary and thinking about the equity as a sweetener, which may or may not come in.
Right. That's an interesting point of view. In terms of the more traditional companies, the large holding companies, the large client-side organizations, why would an employer want to engage in a legal contract with an employee? And I'll have a follow-up.
As a general rule, the contract favors the employee.
The employee?
The employee. Certainly, certain restrictive covenants, certain non-solicitations, potentially non-compete type provisions would benefit the employer, but can often be included in a more of a standard confidentiality non-solicitation agreement without going to long-form employment agreements. The two main reasons why an employer would use an employment agreement is that they realize that they're not going to get an executive of a certain level without it, without a written promise of something. And whether it's a 20-page employment agreement or a 2 or 3 page offer letter generally doesn't matter. To the extent it's signed and it contains the material terms, it may well be an enforceable contract. The other reason that an employer might want one is if it is a fixed term agreement or an agreement where the executive needs to give some significant notice to resign, that can be a benefit to the company as far as stability of the workforce and knowing somebody will be there. And it can also act as a impediment to an executive thinking about leaving if they have to give 6 months notice. Quite honestly, 6 months may be too far out for the new employer to think about holding the job open. They may need to fill it without them.
Well, when you look at balance in your practice, how does it parse out? Is it primarily agency, client side, consulting firms, PE firms? What's the basket look like?
Well, I do about 100 deals a year. Probably 75 to 80% of them are representing executives, but I also do the other 25% representing companies who are in the agency world, the production world, the post-production world, or related IP businesses. When representing the executives, I represent a lot of creatives, a lot of people who are executives at the agencies, at the holding companies, at the media buying companies, often creative people who may switch over and move into more mainstream corporate America, going to work for companies like PepsiCo and Microsoft and Apple and more traditional Fortune 500 companies.
Mm-hmm. Do you find there's a significant difference between, for example, working closely with a creative to negotiate an employment agreement versus an account management person?
I think there is. I think that the creative person oftentimes is less business savvy because they're a left brain person rather than a right brain person. And as a result, perhaps need a little bit more of understanding of the financial aspects of the deal. And then there's the question about the role the attorney plays, whether the attorney advises the client as to things to ask for or think about, or whether the attorney negotiates himself. And again, the business side person might be more likely to take on the negotiations or at least the discussions themselves.
In terms of your skill sets, right? If we were sitting here with a newly minted attorney who's coming into this practice, and we were talking about the skill sets that have made you successful in these complex and delicate negotiations, what would your advice be to this person? What are the three or four things that they should work on? Or better yet, what would make them naturally a good practitioner in this field?
It's a hard question, Dennis. I think that the answer is that while certainly it is legal and that is the basis of what we do, but it's a combination of people skills, both with your client and with your adversary, because as you say, you don't want to blow the deal. You want to ask for things in a respectful manner, but perhaps in a strong manner, and understanding the business and economics of it, having some background in that can be helpful. It's sort of an odd combination of law sprinkled in with business and psychology as to helping people understand things and get to the best place they can.
Do you also represent the client in other words, reversing the situation where the client is asking you to engage with another attorney representing the executive?
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
How does that work? How's the dynamics? 25% of the time on the deals I do, I will structure and draft the deal, and then you will get comments from an attorney or an accountant or a business manager. My hope is that person is somebody who works in the industry that the executive works. I find the biggest impediment is having somebody having a lawyer or other representative who's not industry savvy, because the comments they make are often the wrong comments and comments which are never going to be changed. I would have in the marketing service industry, there's a pretty standard post-term restriction that says for some period, 6 months, a year and a half, maybe up to 2 years, you won't solicit or service clients and you won't hire employees. And I have had scores of attorneys tell me, this is a crazy provision. My client will never be able to get another job in the industry. And I would say, well, everybody who works in the industry at any reputable agency has signed a similar restriction. So your client's going to have to do the same. So people are making perhaps the wrong points. And I'm actually happy if the attorney on the other side knows the industry and what's going on. It makes it an easier negotiation.
Yeah, it makes absolute sense. I want to talk a little bit about severance. Many of our candidates ask us about severance. Are you seeing more instances of companies offering severance today versus, again, 3 to 5 years ago, or about the same? What are you seeing?
Historically, severance is way down from what I will call the old days of the early 90s, the late 80s, even into the late 90s, where people had longer-term pay-or-play contracts or often a longer severance period. Mm-hmm. As the economies started to turn around the turn of the century and then turned again in 2007 and 2008, there was a real pullback in severance people had offered when they realized that it became a very expensive proposition to the companies. That being said, as the economy has started to improve, especially in this area for executives. And given that executives can use a bad past experience as a negotiating tool. Look, I'd love to take this job, but last time I got laid off with 2 weeks severance, and if I don't have a 3 or 4 month package, I just can't take this job. It can often be used as a advantage in a negotiation rather than a disadvantage.
Is 3 or 4 months sort of a standard, or is it perhaps?
It's all over the place. At the mid to senior level executive, 2 months is what I think ought to be the minimum, though you can't always get it. And 6 months is probably the maximum that you're likely to get. There may be an exclusion in the pure entertainment world where people still seem to have longer term deals or longer term pay or play deals.
Is there ever a relationship between the length of severance and the length of time a person has to sit on the sidelines before they go back into the industry?
There are garden leave provisions which have migrated across the pond. It started in England, and the idea is you would stay home and tend your garden while the company was paying you. There are non-competes are a tricky issue in New York, and we can discuss some of the issues and whether you pay or not. Some companies tie the length of severance to the length of notice the executive is required to give. So if you're willing to give 90 days notice, they'll provide you with 90 days severance. If you ask for 6 month severance, they may say yes, but they may tie it to a 6 month notice from you. And it's something you really need to think about, because a 6 month notice provision can be prohibitive as to taking the next position.
Let's take an agency. Would an agency typically want someone who has been severed or has given their resignation to, frankly, hang around for 6 months?
No, but the agency can use the 6 month period to effectively put the person on a garden leave and not use them during that period if they so choose.
Right.
Sometime you'll see agreements which permits the company to have the option of accepting it early and not require any additional pay, or paying it out and either using the executive or putting them effectively on garden leave during the period.
Now, Gavin, I've known you for a while, and it seems to me that you get a kick out of your job. You really like what you do. Why? What's fun about this for you?
I particularly like doing the executive compensation deals because it so matters to the individual. It is literally their life. It's, do I move to Los Angeles and take that job? Do I not? Is the future really in that company? What do you think about this option and how it might work out in the long term? It's fast hitting, it's important, as opposed to certain attorneys who are more involved in representing large corporations where the importance to the individuals they're dealing with seems much less.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a lot of repeat business from the same executive over the course of their career?
Absolutely. Many executives I will represent 3, 4, 5 times, depending upon how many times they switch jobs, but yes. Just this morning I got a call from an executive I had represented a couple of years ago who was now looking at a new job opportunity. The bulk of my new clients come from either a repeat client and a new deal, or an executive referring their friend to me based upon how their deal had worked out.
Are there different enforceability levels in different parts of the country, or is it not location specific?
It is location specific. Most of my executives would be in New York or California, where we have an office, though I am not admitted there. We do represent some executives in other locations. One of the issues is that in connection with media and advertising specifically, there are no lawyers who specialize that in certain locations. So if you're going to go to work for an ad agency in Ohio, and there are ad agencies in Ohio because there are tire companies and rubber companies, et cetera, et cetera. But In that case, if you wanted a lawyer who had this expertise, you would really have to go to New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, or San Francisco.
Now, lots of folks sort of glibly say that employment agreements, they're not enforceable in New York. Is that true?
Well, non-compete agreements.
I'm so sorry.
And the answer is that New York courts frown upon pure non-competes that keep someone from working in industry, but don't take them lightly and don't sign them on that theory unless you happen to have $125,000 to $150,000 sitting around to defend yourself. And even then, we had a client who last week signed with a new employer. They both got sued, and the new employer fired the person to avoid being involved in the litigation.
Well, on that happy note, this is Dennis Troianos, your host of Game Changers Live. Today I had the pleasure of spending time with Gavin McElroy of Frankfurt, Koenig, Klein & Sells. Now, just a programming note, this edition of Game Changers Live is part one of three in a series that I'll be doing with Gavin. Part two and three will focus on M&A deals and how to get your agency or marketing services company well-positioned and prepared for sale. Until then, this is Dennis Troianos for Game Changers Live. Game Changers Live is sponsored by the Troianos Group, retained executive search and management consulting in the marketing arena.